A year after these visits by Lemoyne and Chamorro, severe malnutrition began to appear in Managua and parts of the countryside as U.S. terror and economic warfare continued to take their bitter toll in a pathetically poor country that is utterly dependent on economic relations with the United States for obvious historical and geopolitical reasons. George Shultz, Elliot Abrams, and their cohorts may not have overthrown the government, but they can take pride in having vanquished the programs of development, preventive medical care, and welfare. They can take pride in a notable increase in dying infants, epidemics, and other normal features of the Central American mode to which Nicaragua is to be restored by U.S. benevolence. The propaganda system may cover their tracks today, but history will render a different judgment. Let's return now to the 85 columns in the Washington Post and the New York Times at the peak period of Contra debate. Still more interesting than the uniform hostility to the Sandinistas was the choice of topics. There are two very striking differences between the Sandinistas and the U.S. favorites who adhere to regional standards. The first of these is that the Sandinistas, whatever their sins, had not conducted campaigns of mass slaughter, torture, mutilation, and general terror to traumatize the population. In the 85 columns, there is not one phrase referring to this matter. The second major difference between the Sandinistas and the U.S. clients is that the Sandinistas had diverted resources to the poor majority and had attempted measures of meaningful social reform. In fact, they had done so quite successfully until U.S. economic and military warfare succeeded in reversing the unwelcome improvement in health and welfare standards, literacy, and development. These facts merit two passing phrases in 85 columns, one in a bitter condemnation of what's called the generally appalling leadership in this repressive society. In the 85 columns, there is no mention at all of Sandinista efforts to maintain a neutralist posture. For example, there is no mention of the fact that at the time of the U.S. embargo that has virtually wiped out private business and reduced the economy to bare survival, Nicaraguan trade with the Soviet bloc was about 20% of total trade. That's well below the figure for Europe and most of the Third World. That fact is inconsistent with required dogma, and therefore it is unmentionable in the media, anywhere to my knowledge. Let's turn now to another sample of opinion in the media a year later. In the first 6 months of 1987, the same two journals, the New York Times and the Washington Post, ran 61 columns and editorials relevant to U.S. policy in Nicaragua. Of these, 13 said nothing about the Sandinistas. Of the 48 that expressed an opinion, 46 were anti-Sandinista, again, most of them bitterly so. Of the two columns that expressed some sympathy for the Sandinistas, one was by Nicaraguan Ambassador Carlos Tunnerman. The other was by Dr. Kevin Cahill. He is the director of the Tropical Disease Center at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York, the only non-Nicaraguan commentator in the sample who could draw upon personal experience in Nicaragua and elsewhere in the Third World. His column was also the only one that took note of the successful Nicaraguan health and literacy measures and what he called the struggle against oppression and corruption, waged under conditions of extreme adversity imposed by U.S. terror and economic warfare. Cahill's is also the one of the two contributions among 61 that mention the World Court decision and international law. Once again, in these 61 columns, there is not a single phrase referring to the fact that unlike the U.S. clients in the so-called fledgling democracies, the Sandinistas had not launched a campaign of terror and slaughter to traumatize their populations. The totalitarian Sandinistas are contrasted with the struggling democracies of Central America, the imperfect but working democracy of Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador, which, although under communist guerrilla siege, is an imperfect democracy, but a democracy with an elected government. Notice that it is unlike Nicaragua, where there were no elections, so Washington has decreed. Well after the 1984 elections, that established democracy in El Salvador to the applause of the free press, the human rights organization Socorro Juridico, which operates under the protection of the Archdiocese of San Salvador, observed that the continuing terror is still conducted by the same members of the armed forces who enjoy official approval and are adequately trained to carry out these acts of collective suffering. Salvadoran society, affected by terror and panic, a result of the persistent violation of basic human rights, shows the following traits, they said. Collective intimidation and generalized fear on the one hand, and on the other, the internalized acceptance of the terror because of the daily and frequent use of violent means. In general, society accepts the frequent appearance of tortured bodies because basic rights, including the right to life, have absolutely no overriding value for society. These comments also apply to the supervisors of these operations in Washington. That fact was underscored by George Shultz in one of his lamentations on terrorism, a talk that he delivered at the very moment of the U.S. bombing of Libya. In El Salvador, he declared, "The results are something all Americans can be proud of. At least, all Americans who enjoy the sight of tortured bodies, starving children, terror and panic, and generalized fear." And James LeMoyne of the New York Times concludes that American support for elected governments in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras has been a relative success, which is no doubt true by some standards. The problem throughout, according to the media, is to find some way to compel Nicaragua to rein in its revolutionary army, as Democratic Senator Terry Sanford demands, an army that is illegitimately rampaging inside Nicaragua when it seeks to defend the country from U.S. attack. Apart from regular unsupported allegations of Sandinista aid to the Salvadoran guerrillas, the proclaimed basis for the fears of Sandinista aggression is another coup of the State Department propaganda services in what they called their Operation Truth. This is based upon a speech in which Comandante Tomas Borges expressed his hopes that Nicaragua would be an example that others would follow. He explained that Nicaragua cannot export our revolution, but can only export our example, while the people themselves of these countries must make their own revolutions. In this sense, he said, the Nicaraguan revolution transcends national boundaries. In a conscious and purposeful fraud, State Department psychological warfare operations converted these words into the threat of military conquest in pursuit of a revolution without borders. That phrase was used as the title of the pathetic September 1985 State Department white paper on alleged Nicaraguan aggression, and it's constantly been used since, often accompanied by the claim that this is a Sandinista Mein Kampf, as George Shultz warned Congress. The same fabrication served as the climax for Reagan's successful effort to obtain $100 million from Congress for the proxy army, just as the World Court called upon the United States to terminate its aggression. And the phrase remains a media staple in news columns and commentary. The hoax was publicly exposed at once, but this did not deter media agitprop in service of the worthy project of demonizing the Sandinista government and turning it into a real enemy and threat in the minds of the American people, as a Reagan administration official phrased the goal. Nor are these exercises deterred by the evident absurdity of the idea that Nicaragua could pose a threat of aggression while the United States stands by in helpless impotence. Again, this is a most impressive demonstration of what can be achieved by a mobilized independent press. There was, to be sure, a basis for the perception that Nicaragua poses a threat. As Oxfam observed, Nicaragua posed the threat of a good example. Like Arevalo and Arbenz in Guatemala, Allende in Chile, and many others, Nicaragua was perceived as a rotten apple that might infect the barrel, a virus that might infect others, a cancer that might spread. This is the terminology that is constantly used by planners when they contemplate the dread prospect of independent development geared to domestic needs. The real fear was expressed by Secretary of State Shultz in March 1986. He warned that if the Sandinistas succeed in consolidating their power, then all the countries in Latin America, who all face serious internal economic problems, will see radical forces emboldened to exploit these problems. His words. It is therefore necessary to destroy the virus and inoculate the surrounding regions by terror. That's a persistent feature of U.S. foreign policy, but these truths, too, lie far beyond expression in the media. The range of opinion that is permitted expression, and the way the news is filtered and adjusted, ensures that public opinion will not stray from proper bounds, at least among the elite groups that count.
The 1988 Massey Lectures continue tomorrow night on Ideas, presented by Noam Chomsky. Several weeks ago, Professor Chomsky presented some of the material in these lectures to an audience at Ryerson Polytechnical Institute in Toronto, after which he was questioned by a panel of Canadian journalists. You'll hear parts of that panel discussion each night this week. This is David Frum, associate editor of Saturday Night Magazine.
Professor Chomsky, you argue for a model of the media in which the media argue for and defend the established institutions of society, and any deviation from that defense is dismissed or even suppressed, so that views that are that dissent from the overwhelming consensus that characterizes our society cannot get a hearing. Now, here you are tonight in a large lecture hall at Canada's most prestigious journalism school, speaking to an audience of journalists who are hearing your remarks with apparent approbation. Your remarks are being broadcast on the government-owned radio network as part of the most prestigious lecture series on that network. How'd that happen?
Recall that what I said was that this is a very good first approximation to the description of a complex social institution. You remember that I mentioned, I'm afraid this remark may sound a little insulting, but let me try to say it without sounding that way. I specifically mentioned that in the United States, for example, if I wasn't talking about, say, listener-supported radio in a small community. In fact, as you get away from the elite centers that matter, things open up. Okay. Now, the fact of the matter is that Canada is a much more open society in this respect than the United States, and the reason is it's less important. This generalizes. I can talk this way in Belgium, you know, in Israel, in Latin America. I can't talk I can talk this way in the United States, but not on national radio and television because it's just too important. What people think about international affairs in Canada just doesn't matter that much to established power. If it did matter that much, Canada would close up too.
If CBC then is just a small a publicly funded station in some small town looked upon to that perspective, why don't we turn to the CBC person on stage here, and Margaret Daly, perhaps you can have a turn.
Well, I was intrigued by the thesis and particularly impressed by the volume of sort of factual documentation that I look forward to reading this stuff in a long version. I guess the question that I want to ask, though, is, given that this information is so, given that this information isn't discussed, you lay it all out, supposing people knew it. And obviously individuals do know it. Minorities, intellectuals, foreign affairs buffs, if you want to call them that, those kinds of people can assemble all this information. Then what? It doesn't seem to make any difference, and why is that?
Well, I think it does make a difference. I think it makes a lot of difference. I mentioned, not entirely jocularly, that if a third world country today were to put forth the American Constitution, we'd call it a reversion to Nazism. And I mentioned that that's a sign of hope and progress. There has been moral progress over 200 years. There's also been progress over 20 years, 30 years, I mean, my active lifetime. Again, I'm talking mostly about the United States, but it's a different country than it was 20 or 30 years ago. Now, elites are not different. They're pretty much as indoctrinated as they always were. elite group, contrary to a lot of necessary illusion, elite groups, including liberal intellectual elites, did not oppose the Vietnam War. They supported the Vietnam War, supported it enthusiastically. They began to turn against it somewhat after Wall Street turned against it, and more or less for the same reasons, because it was too costly. The media were almost totally closed to critics of the war. But among the general population, this crisis of democracy did take place, and it changed the society. I think it led to a permanent cultural change outside the elite centers. And the United States is just a different country than it was 20 years ago in a lot of respects. Everything from interpersonal relations to treatment of ethnic minorities to concern over international affairs and so on. You can see, and the reason is because while the major institutions of indoctrination continue on their natural course, other modes of interaction did develop. And they remained, you know, they're informal, they're inefficient. Probably 80%, I don't know, some huge percent of my time traveling around the country giving talks. Well, you know, that's less efficient than writing for a major journal, but people do this, and ultimately it makes a difference. There are solidarity groups, there are all kind of organizations and so on, and they do make a difference. You can see it. So take, for example, I mentioned the U.S. attack against South Vietnam in the early 1960s. You compare the early 1960s with the 1980s, that's 20 years. When Ronald Reagan came into office, his administration, in my view, intended to emulate John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, except their target was Central America. They came out with a white paper in February 1981, right after they came into office, virtually a declaration of war. The communists are taking over the world. We've got to go in there and stop them. It was a precursor to direct U.S. military intervention in Central America. Now, what happened? The media, incidentally, bought the whole story. There was virtually no criticism of the white paper when it came out, just enthusiastic support for it. However, the general population didn't, because the population is not what it was in the early 60s. When John F. Kennedy started sending the American Air Force to bomb South Vietnam on a regular basis, there was no protest. You couldn't get two people together in a living room to talk about it. And it didn't have to be hidden either. It was on the front page of the newspapers. Nobody cared. We want to bomb another country? Great. You know, let's go to the next thing. When Ronald Reagan's administration indicated that they might try to turn to direct military intervention, there was a convulsion in the country. People started coming out of the woodworks. It ranged from a massive flow of letters to Washington, to demonstrations, to church groups getting involved. A whole array of protests began to develop spontaneously without any organization and structure. The reason is the country is just a lot different. Well, what happened? What happened is that the Reagan administration backed off. They, in fact, told the media to cool the rhetoric, to cut back the inflammatory rhetoric. They were afraid that much more central themes of their program would be endangered. After all, remember that they were trying to ram through a program that the population was strongly opposed to, a domestic economic program. They were trying to ram through destruction of the limited welfare measures that exist in the United States, a huge transfer of resources from the poor to the rich, a massive increase in state power, and huge public subsidy to high technology industry through the Pentagon system and so on. All of these things are contrary to what the public wanted. And they didn't want any protest about them. So what they did was back off from their inflammatory proclamations about Central America, and they went underground. That's what the Iran-Contra hearings were about. The administration was driven underground. The domestic population would not tolerate the activities that they wanted to carry out, and they therefore had to turn to illegal clandestine activities. Now, the Reagan administration was notorious for the level of its clandestine activities. And clandestine activities are a pretty good measure of popular dissidence. If there isn't any popular dissidence, you don't have to carry out clandestine activities. You can carry out overt international terrorism and violence, which is much more efficient. Overt violence is much more efficient than clandestine violence, for obvious reasons. I mean, for one thing, it's just more efficient to do. For another thing, there isn't any risk that it'll be exposed. which will cause, you know, a scandal and so on and so forth. And in fact, the state was driven underground by popular dissidents. Well, that's important. You know, those are, I think that's one of the many reflections of the difference between the 1960s and the 1980s. I think there's, and in fact, even the media are different. Bad as they are, I mean, as you can see, I'm no great enthusiast for the elite media, but they're better than they were 20 years ago. I mean, they're not as closed and restricted and constrained as they were 20 years ago, and that includes the elite media. So there are slow changes, and I think there is a slow move towards general democratization, much too slow, but not insignificant. And those are things that, first of all, one can be somewhat hopeful about, but it also teaches you a lesson. It means there are things you can do. After all, these are societies. Our societies, like Canada and the United States, have one tremendous virtue. The state is very restricted in its capacity to use force against citizens. By comparative, it's not zero, but by comparative standards, it's low. And that means there's a great range of options available. People want to make use of them, and many do, and it makes a difference.